Among the many hats that I've been privileged to wear over the years has been my relationship with an organization known as Nefesh. Way back at the very beginning of Nefesh, we tried to make an acronym out of it and figure out what it could possibly stand for, but that didn't quite work. And so it's just called Nefesh, an international network of Orthodox Jewish mental health professionals. Chavi and I were involved really in the first attempt to organize a group of mental health professionals, affirmed mental health professionals, long, long ago, long before Nefesh started. And we had a small group going, and it lasted for a while. And we were successful in finding an acronym for the organization then. And the acronym was OOPS, O-O-P-S, Organization of Orthodox Psychological Services, or something like that. But that for many reasons didn't work out. Actually, it's a comment on the sociology of Orthodox professional life in general. This attempt was done in the early 1970s. There were very, very few yeshiva graduates, male or female, who were entering and were in the profession of mental health in those years. And there simply wasn't the critical mass, even nationally, to really get an organization off the ground. However, 20 or 25 years later, a group of people decided we're going to try again and bring together a bunch of Orthodox mental health professionals to make sure that we had a turnout. It was going to be in a Miami Beach hotel in January. And we expected 50 people. We got about 350 people. We had a real difficulty scrambling for a facility. And that kind of launched Nefesh. And at this point in time, it's really impossible for me to even begin to keep up with the membership list. There are very active chapters in several countries in South America, across the United States and Canada, in London and South Africa, and a very, very interesting group in Israel. And at the beginning, we decided that there are those of us who were rabbis and mental health professionals, and we should each have roles in it. We had little titles, and my title was Rabbinic Liaison. Actually, my original task was to try to bring rabbis who were not mental health professionals to Nefesh events in order to give them some sort of training and exposure to mental health techniques, to mental health ethics. And in that role, I was only successful in a limited way. But over the years, people began to see my name is on the stationery as Rabbinic Liaison, so professionals would contact me with various issues that they were having, clinical issues usually, which were connected with hashkafic issues, halachic issues, or more frequently, Jewish institutional issues. They were up against difficulties with schools, with shuls, with rabbis, with batei din, etc. And they asked me to help them negotiate these more political types of situations. So my role is a kind of an eclectic one. And it kind of waxes and wanes with the years. There are times when I really have no exposure to the Nefesh professionals, and there are times when I am inundated by it. And it seems to me that the people who consult with me, who reach out to me, are very, very much aware of the pattern of my own personal professional career. And they know that when I was executive vice president of the OU, I wouldn't have time for all these kinds of consultations. They, Baruch Hashem, kind of let me be. Once they found out that I stepped down from that position and was an emeritus, I've received more and more calls over recent couple of years. And in the process, I find myself, again, with a bifurcated interest in the material that's brought to me. On the one hand, I see it very much in terms of the the dynamics of the relationship. Why is this person reaching out to me? Why me of all people? There are plenty of other experts out there for them to consult. What are they looking for? What are their issues? What are their clinical issues? What are their personal issues? So it's very much akin to the relationship of a clinical supervisor and a psychiatrist, a psychologist in training. That's one aspect of it, which I'll address somewhat. The other aspect of it is that it gives me, because of my interest in general issues, community-wide issues of mental health in the Jewish community, it gives me kind of a window into what's really going on out there, into some problems that are really prevalent and really need to be looked at. I mean, all people look at any community, but certainly the Orthodox Jewish community through some kind of glasses, sometimes dark glasses, sometimes rose-colored glasses, but we all have our way of looking at the community, and often we don't see what's going on underneath or inside or behind closed doors. And a lot of the reports that I get from people out in the field give me a glimpse into some of the underlying problems of community mental health in the Frum community. I don't know if you know what Frum means. Anybody know what Frum means? I mean, it's the term that we use. It, in many ways, fits better somehow than Orthodox or observant. By the way, I have gotten in trouble for using the term observant when I mean Orthodox, because many non-Orthodox people consider themselves rightfully to be observant. They may not observe exactly the same manner or the same kinds of things that Orthodox people observe. What does Frum mean? Frum comes from a German word which means pious. Pious, P-I-O-U-S. But Hasidim often say that they have a different meaning for Frum. It's Fei, Resh, Yud, Mem, and it's an acronym for Feel Rishus Veinig Mitzvahs. A lot of cruelty and very, very few mitzvahs. So whoever invented that acronym 100 or 200 years ago, Yiddish-speaking person obviously, was already aware with some of the problems of hypocrisy in the pious community. That people, the externals are one thing, and what's going on internally, certainly phenomenologically, may not be so pious. I say that not out of cynicism, but out of a need for us to really confront a very, very important issue in Orthodox Jewish life, and that is what in Hebrew is called chitzoniut versus pnimiut. Chitzoniut is the external appearance, and pnimiut is what's going on inside. It's interesting to me because I do frequent and certainly study the teachings and preachings of the leadership of the Haredi community, Hasidish and otherwise, and it's very interesting that the theme of the need for pnimiut, the need for sincerity, authenticity, and inwardness, is a common theme among Rashi Yeshiva, among Hasidish Rebbes. That's what they are preaching. You go to a Tisha the Ger Rebbe, or the Vizhnitzer Rebbe, or the Majitzer Rebbe, or the Rashi Yeshivas, the Mashkichim and Yeshivos, and you see that, you listen carefully, you see that they are on to this problem. There's a chitzoniyut, an outward appearance, such as a black hat or a shtreimel or a kaftan or whatever it happens to be. And then there's the pnimiyut, what's going on inside. And the need to, so often there's a great discrepancy between the two. And of course, when one deals, when one speaks with, when one is confronted with the data that is presented by people who, by definition, are working with the pnimiyut, right, that's what it's all about, mental health. You're sitting with a person and looking at his pnimiyut, that's his or her inside, secrets, private world, etc. Then you see some things which can be very, very troubling. I don't know, and I don't think anyone knows, to what extent the population that is seen for psychotherapy by mental health professionals in the Frum world reflects the general population. Maybe there's a special subpopulation that has had these issues. Maybe there's a special subpopulation that comes for treatment. To what extent can you generalize from the patients that you see or the patients that the couple of dozen of people who talk to me who are professionals in the field, what they see, how much does that reflect the general population? You can ask the same question that people have asked it about Freud. What gave Freud the right to be an expert on human nature? Basically, he was seeing wealthy, neurotic Jewish women in Vienna. I mean, that's a very, very narrow population. How can you generalize from that to mankind? We have the same question. How can we generalize, those of us who are in the mental health field, from the people that we see to the general population? Maybe the general population in the Orthodox world, their marriages are trouble-free, there are no issues of abuse, there are no issues of learning disabilities, etc. It's only those, you know, small percentage that come to us. I don't know the answer to that, but I suspect that there is some correspondence between the patient population seen by professionals who see from people and the rest of the from world. I want to talk about some of the issues that are out there and rather prevalent. Just some of them, there are many. Just kind of lay them out with you and maybe comment on a few of them. And then share with you some of what I try to impart to some of these professionals in terms of what I think could be helpful to them from a spiritual perspective, from their spirituality perspective. So that's my outline of my talk, by the way, is on page 167 in the spiral binder. And I just commented to you on Roman numeral 1, which is the nature of the type of consultation that I'm speaking about and its troubling features. We'll have some more to say about its troubling features. I do want to say that I added, subsequent to the point in time when I submitted this to the Torah in Motion people to include in their binder, I added on a Roman numeral 7 and a Roman numeral 8, and I want to just share them to you because they are very, very important references on two extremely important topics that, for whatever reason, I didn't think of when I first sat down to organize this thought. So Roman numeral 7 is a book. It's by Rabbi Chaim Rappaport. He spells it R-A-P-O-P-O-R-T, Rappaport. And the name of the book is Judaism and Homosexuality, An Authentic Orthodox View. Published in 2004, and it's like everything else of this nature is available easily on Amazon and similar websites. That's Roman numeral 7. And Roman numeral 8 is a book that I found extremely instructive to me on the subject of eating disorders. Javi and I spent a Shabbos in Denver, Colorado, not so long ago. We met some interesting people there, including a physician named Dr. Philip Meller, M-E-H-L-E-R, who's a frum fellow, an Orthodox Jewish physician, whose specialty is the medical aspects of eating disorders. I found him very useful as a referral resource, but also as someone who has a rather different spin and take on eating disorders than the one that I was trained in, the one that Dr. Friedman spoke about the other day. He comes from a very, very medically based point of view, non-psychological, not anti-psychological, but non-psychological. And he, Philip Mahler, M-E-H-L-E-R, and his colleague Arnold Anderson, A-N-D-E-R-S-E-N, wrote a book just a year ago, published in early 2010, Eating Disorders, A Guide to Medical Care and Complications. So, Eating Disorders, A Guide to Medical Care and Complications by Mahler, M-E-H-L-E-R, and Anderson, A-N-D-E-R-S-E-N. So that's Roman numerals 7 and 8. I doubt if we'll get today to either of those topics in great depth, but they are both extremely important issues in the Orthodox or Frum community. My introduction to the shameful underside of Orthodox Jewish life came rather late in my career. I was practiced psychology in the Orthodox community and in other communities for many, many years. I was a rabbi, a pulpit rabbi in the shul of Baltimore for a number of years before I began to be introduced to the entire issue of abuse, very general issue, abuse in our community. And specifically, my introduction was to domestic violence. And I was introduced to the topic of domestic violence and how prevalent it is, was then and continues to be in the Orthodox Jewish community by a very noble woman whose name is Mrs. Hannah Weinberg. She is the widow of the Rosh Yeshiva, the former Rosh Yeshiva of Neger Yisrael, who passed away some years ago. So she is in a position of extreme prestige and influence, certainly in the yeshiva world, as a rebbetzin of the daughter, by the way, of Rav Ruderman, and the widow of his son-in-law, of the second Rosh Yeshiva of Rav Weinberg. So she is, as a rebbetzin in that position, quite influential. And she became aware of the problem of domestic violence, of spouse abuse in the Frum community. And she was then even more so, but even now as she's aging, still a very dynamic woman who gets things done. And she learned a lot about domestic violence, tried to convince the rabbinate, the Baltimore rabbinate, the national American rabbinate, about the prevalence of this issue and the need to intervene. She, on her own, with her own, without any organizational support, etc., established several safe houses for women who were being abused to escape to. At the later point in time, it became my role. I was one of the two or three people in the entire city who knew the location of these safe houses. I had to be told the location because I had to make sure the kitchens were kosher and the mezuzahs were done properly, etc. So I knew where they were. And she introduced me to the field of domestic violence. And making a long, long story short, I became aware that I had been trained and practicing at that point for over 20 years in the field of marriage counseling, and was mostly a waste of time, and I was really taking people's money for nothing. And the reason was that I began to reflect upon my caseload, both in the Orthodox Jewish world and other patient population that I've seen. I mentioned yesterday Vedanta, Hindus, etc. That I was working with people in marriage counseling for many, many sessions, dozens, hundreds of sessions sometimes, and never asked the question. All right, this is a term that comes from the feminist approach to psychotherapy, especially to marriage counseling. You've got to, quote, ask the question. What's the question? The question is, has he ever hit you? did he or she ever resort to physical means to solve problems? Did he ever strike you? Did he ever push you, punch you, etc.? We were trained not to ask that question. We were trained to do marriage counseling and let whatever came out come out, and deal just with what came out, and not to ask certain probing kinds of questions. That's how I was trained in the late 1960s, early 1970s, and that's how we were trained to do marriage counseling. And often it was just missing the most important point, that there was physical violence going on, usually male spouse to female spouse, sometimes the other way, and was just being ignored. The couple wouldn't bring it up. He was ashamed, she was ashamed, whatever. Often the victim would cover up for the perpetrator. That's not an uncommon dynamic, for the victim to protect the perpetrator. It sounds paradoxical, and it is paradoxical, but it's often the case. And by not asking the question, you're really wasting a lot of people's time. You ask the question, you bring it to the surface, you can deal with it or not deal with it, as the case may be. But that was just, I began to do this with my Orthodox patients, and began to see that there was no lack of physical violence going on in the marriages, including the marriages of some quite prominent people within the Orthodox Jewish community. This remains a problem to this day, perhaps less so. It certainly is more openly discussed than it used to be. There's still a heck of a lot of denial out there. Sometimes just innocent, normal, average denial, and sometimes pernicious, criminal denial. But the problem is now at least out in the open and being discussed, and there are various places to go to. There are organizations like Shalom Task Force who bring educational preventative programs into the various schools, yeshivot. There are referral hotlines, etc., that are available in every major Jewish community, certainly in the United States and Canada, and in Israel, where it is a major, major social problem, especially in certain subcultures where physical violence from male spouse to female spouse are almost seen as that's the way you relate. I mean, that's the mitzvah, etc. So that's one area, etc. But then I began to become aware of and exposed to the problem of sexual abuse in the Orthodox Jewish community, sexual abuse of one spouse of another, which is one form of domestic violence, marital rape, etc. But more troubling in some ways, incest and boundary violations of all sorts of egregious types, including teachers, rabbis, etc., to patients and clients, but often to children, sometimes very, very young, almost unbelievably young children who become victims of sexual abuse. Treatment issues, maybe this is not the forum for that, but there's one issue that's extremely troubling to me, and it's, again, I mentioned in my first presentation on Friday, a lot of what I have to talk about is neither medical nor psychological, nor having to do with ethics or even halacha so much as it is political. That's the world that I live in most of my time, the world of Jewish politics. And the question has come up within the community at large, left to right, of whether or not you report sexual abuse or other kinds of abuse to civil authorities. Is it permissible for a Jew to go beyond the Jewish community and go to the police, social welfare department, or whatever, to report criminal behavior, especially abuse, and more especially sexual abuse. And the reason not to is halakhically interesting. After all, we're supposed to bring our difficulties to a Beit Din. We're supposed to bring our difficulties to our local rabbi. We're supposed to help solve our issues intra community and not bring them outside to the Erkaot, to the Jewish, to the Gentile courts, or to the Gentile world for various reasons. However, remember when this problem first came to my attention, and I was first asked the question, do we report this or not? I have some degree of rabbinic training, some degree of erudition, but I couldn't see what the shaila was. I mean, I didn't understand what the problem is. And my immediate gut reaction was, and this remains my reaction today, you know, when there's a fire in the house, you call the fire department. You don't call the rabbi. I mean, the rabbi is, even on Shabbos, which is an interesting thing, because if you study Talmud, you don't call the fire department necessarily when there's a fire on Shabbos. However, over the centuries, and certainly the ruling of the Shulchan Aruch is, if there's a fire in your house on Shabbos, you violate Shabbos and call the fire department. This is true even on Shabbos, but it's certainly true on a Tuesday or a Thursday. Monday and a Thursday. And that was my gut reaction. And over the years, I've become more and more convinced that from every point of view, halachic, kashkafic, political, ethical, legal, etc., that this is the real answer. If there's criminal behavior going on, your responsibility as a victim, as a bystander, as a professional who's observing the situation is to move effectively and do whatever has to be done to protect the victim of whatever kind of abuse it is. That was alluded to in one of the halakhic discourses we heard. Lo ta'amod al dam re'acha. You're not supposed to stand idly by when someone else is suffering. Certainly when someone else is in danger of murder, of death. And all abuse has a certain degree of risk toward instant or eventual death, including emotional abuse, it can be killing, it can drive a person to depression and to suicide, etc. So you do whatever has to be done effectively, and in most cases, what you do is go to the relevant authorities. What's interesting is that I and others who felt my way have been subject over the years to vilification. Now, how can you dare say this? Going to the goyim, you're going, not going through a Beis Din, you have to ask your rav, you have to ask your shaylach, and you just say, go to the fire department or the police department or the social services system or whatever. So interestingly enough, some years ago, maybe it's about 6 years ago now, a number of rabbanim who were against reporting because of their opinions went and asked the question of Rabbi Yashiv, who's been referred to again and again today as the single living authority, certainly the oldest living authority. He's over 101 years old. He should continue to live and be well. He just had some serious surgery and seems to, according to Rabbi Steinberg, who's very close with him, seems to be doing very, very well considering his age and the condition he had. But he wrote a tshuva. And this is not something that people can say, well, I heard Rabbi Yashiv said this, or I was told Rabbi Yashiv said this. This is the tshuva that he wrote. Not a very lengthy one, not even a very intricate one. It's in the, there's a annual, a biannual publication called Yeshurun. It's a thick black volume. Look in volume 15. I think it was published in 2004 or 2006. And you will see the question as posed to Rabbi Yashiv, and you will see his answer in no uncertain terms. He makes clear, this goes for Israel, this goes for anywhere else. If there's abuse, a reasonable suspicion of abuse, whatever kind, whether it's sexual, he spelled out the word sexual, or physical, or whatever, you go to the civil authorities. And he just lists a few Talmudic sources, few halakhic sources for his opinion, and signs it, you know, may the Jewish people be blessed not to know of such problems, etc., Rabbi Yashiv. That, in that particular volume of Yeshurun Tesvav, Yeshurun volume 15, that one-page responsum of Rabbi Yashiv is followed up by three or four lengthy, lengthy articles, 20, 30, 40 pages, with all sorts of analyses from some lesser figures than Rabbi Yashiv, but still prominent halakhic experts, Rabbi Yosher Weiss, Rav Zalman Yathamiel Goldberg, whose name has been mentioned here, etc., which elaborate upon his opinion and urge people to report sexual abuse and other kinds of abuse to the relevant civil authorities when there is reasonable reason to, reasonable basis to suspect abuse. But that word reasonable, of course, is a word that you can kind of, it's a wide range of interpretations. What's reasonable and what's not? What's interesting is that by the time, this is volume 15 of this Torah journal, by the time volume 22 came out, which is just recently within the past year, what's reasonable? Can an average ordinary person decide on his or her own what is reasonable? And therefore, there were a number of people, this was the theme of a recent day for professionals, for mental health and medical professionals held by Agudas Yisroel, where the executive vice president of Agudas Yisroel, Rabbi Zvi Bell, who is a member of the bar, and another gentleman by the name of Rabbi Shlomo Gottesman, who is also a member of the bar of New York State, both said that a professional, we're not talking about a parent or ordinary citizen, they for sure cannot be trusted to make a reasonable judgment. But even a professional who is, by the dictates of his profession, bound to report, should not report without first consulting a rabbi who is knowledgeable in this field. And the logical basis of their thinking is, you know, yes, Rabbi Yashiv said it's permissible to report reasonable suspicion, but can the average person be trusted to make a reasonable judgment? The average person must go to his or rav, and that rav can serve to determine whether there is a reasonable basis or not. Well, I know I'm on being recorded here, so I have to be careful exactly how I phrase this, but my experience has been that, my experience has been, it might be self my experience, that the average person out there is usually more capable of making a reasonable judgment about these matters than some of the rabbis that I know. So just to go to quote a rabbi because he's more reasonable, you know, nowhere does it say, by the way, in any of the halakhic literature, or going back to, I don't know when, to this current day, that rabbanim are more reasonable or more intelligent or more capable of anything except teaching than anybody else. Right? This is not, we are not Catholics. We don't believe that ordination gives a person any magic powers or even any legal powers, even any halakhic powers over anyone else. Alright? All that means if you have smicha is that you studied certain texts and mastered them. It doesn't even mean that you took a pastoral counseling course from Dr. Friedman. All it means is that you've mastered certain volumes of the Shulchan Aruch, not even all of the Shulchan Aruch, and usually those parts of the Shulchan Aruch that have zilch to do with the kinds of topics we've been talking about here. And most smicha programs that I know, including the more liberal ones, most of the time is spent studying the laws of Shechita, the laws of Kashrus, etc., very, very important, but very, even the kinds of things we're talking about here from a halakhic perspective are not usually on the curriculum of a smicha course, end of life issues, etc. That's usually when you study Yeridaya. I know when I studied Yeridaya, we never got past Taruvah Sabasa V'Cholov. We never learned about Yayin Nesech, and we never learned about end of life issues. We never learned about the laws of Refuah, and we certainly did not learn about the laws of when to report, or how to report, or if to report child abuse. So therefore, it's the opinion of many people, and it's been the opinion of Rav Heschel Schechter for some time, that it's not only permissible, but it's a mitzvah to report in our society, to report to civil authorities these kinds of abuse. Again, when there's reasonable suspicion. Obviously, this itself can be abused. People often, for various reasons, accuse people who are perfectly innocent of all sorts of terrible things. That happens. That's a risk. In my experience, that's a very, very small percentage of the problem. So that's Roman numeral 2, and obviously this is an ongoing debate. This conference by Agudas Yisrael was really just three or four weeks ago. So this is an ongoing type of situation. I want to allude to, in Roman numeral 3, to things which is something that come up before here, both informal and formal presentations, and that is the phenomenon known as flipping and the family. Flipping is a phenomenon that originally, the term flipping was of course invented, as most of these terms are invented, by kids. Because our kids, the high school age, early college age, are familiar with the phenomenon of a child of a, whatever, I hate the term modern Orthodox, I still don't know what it means, but someone from a center of the road, middle of the road, from background, sent their child to Eretz Yisroel for the year, and the child comes back with his chitzoniyut, and possibly even his pnimiyut, very, very much changed. His mode of dress, his way of davening, his hashkafa, his worldview, his Zionistic views, all become very, very much different from his family of origin. And his friends say of him, usually it's, I'm not familiar yet, I know this phenomenon exists among girls, but I don't know that as well firsthand as with boys. And the boy's friends will often say of him, he, she, Shimon, Beryl, Yankel has flipped out. There's another type of flipping out, which is in the other direction, that the child is brought up in a fervent Orthodox home, right wing, left wing, center wing, no wing, etc., and goes in the other direction, rejects the family's values, and goes elsewhere, wherever it happens to be, off the derech or whatever. What is it all about, this phenomenon of flipping? The book Off the Derech by whatever her name is, Margolies, is a very, very good book, and I recommend that to you. But I urge you, once you read what she's writing, because she's speaking about flipping off in the direction of non-observance, a lot of what she says applies equally well to flipping out in the direction of greater or more scrupulous observance. But I have a theory which I learned from a fascinating psychoanalyst who was an expert in adolescent psychiatry. His name, I don't know if he's still alive, most of the books that I read on this subject go back to my graduate school days, which is, I'm talking to people around here, I went to graduate school before some of you were born. So I'm talking about the early 1970s, and I was trained in a postgraduate program at the Washington School of Psychiatry, and had a visiting lecturer there one semester whose name was Helmut Stierlin. I guess it's spelled S-T-I-E-R-L-I-N. And he taught me a lot of what I know about adolescent psychodynamics. And he pointed out something fascinating. Very simple, but it's just fascinating. He says, when you look at an adolescent who is doing what adolescents do, or acting out this way or that way, rebelling or conforming and becoming more firm or less firm or not firm or whatever, or he didn't know about these kinds of sociological phenomena, but he looked especially at runaways. But you look at an adolescent who's going through his or her issues. You have to look also at their parents, because the adolescent is going through a certain developmental stage. And we know all that's been written, Eric Erickson and others. Did you know, by the way, Eric Erickson is Jewish? Was Jewish? I don't know if plenty of people knew that. It's fascinating. And like Eric Erickson, you would think, you know, he's a... But no, he too is Jewish. But in any case, identity issues, adolescent struggling with the issues of who am I, trying to define himself, a little bit in rebellion, a little bit susceptible to certain types of ego ideals in his environment or her environment, etc. That's adolescence. But still, instead, let's take a look at the parents of the adolescent. How old are they? Well, somewhere about 40. Well, what issues are they going through? He was talking in the 20th century, but in 21st century Western civilization, the same thing. What issues is a 40-year-old going through? Who am I? Why do I make these choices? You know, am I stuck in this marriage or in this career? What options are there for me? Who am I really? What, to use the language of the musician last night, what costumes am I wearing and need to shed or try on different ones, etc.? So the adult is going through the same issues, same developmental issues, as is the adolescent. There's a difference, however. The adolescent has a certain number of degrees of freedom to be what he or she darn pleases. Not total freedom, obviously. None of us are totally free. But the adolescent can make various choices. Career choices, choices of spouse, of mate, choices of direction in life, choices of degree of religiosity, etc., etc. An adolescent has those choices in front of him or her. The 40-year-old may philosophically have those issues, but in practical terms does not. Because if he's 40 and in the midlife crisis and beginning to say, gee, I wish I didn't marry Susie or Bela or Yenta, whomever, he can fantasize about, I wish you would have married someone else or not married and still be single or whatever, and is going through these issues. But in practical terms, what am I going to do? I'm married to the lady for 25 years. We have 4 kids together. You know, she earns more money than me, etc. So, you know, I'm not about to just get out of the marriage. And the same thing is true for Frumkeit. I made a choice 20 years ago when someone found me by the Western Wall and told me not to go to graduate school in Dartmouth, but to go to yeshiva, etc., etc. So I made those decisions. Now I'm 20 years down the road, and I'm beginning to wonder, did I make the right choices? This is normal midlife crisis kinds of issues, but he feels constrained and restrained because in practical terms, the options aren't open to him. So what does he do? Let's say what he really wanted to be is a kollel person. That's what he really wanted to be. But now he's 40 and he's an accountant or insurance salesman or a physician or whatever. But he really would have liked to be a kollel person. And which Orthodox Jewish male, I don't know, Dr. Friedman can speak about female ideals, but they're probably true of women too. It's a great life, the kollel life. You're sitting and learning. You know you're doing what God wants you to do. You're learning all the time. It's fascinating. It's interesting. You don't have to work too hard physically. There are all sorts of benefits in being a kollel person. Practical, material benefits, for sure, but also spiritual, intellectual benefits. But I can't do this anymore. Can I got to put bread on the table, pay for exorbitant tuitions just for starters, etc., 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 so I don't have the choice. But my 18-year-old, he can do that. So I'm here for going to encourage him as he begins to show signs of moving in that direction, moving, sliding to the right, I'm going to cheer him on. I'm going to give him a credit card when he spends his year or two in Yerushalayim so he can have whatever he needs, etc., etc., etc. At the same time, this 40-year-old parent, father or mother, will also say, yeah, sure, part of me would love to be Monday's fantasy when I'm 40, is that I wish I would have chosen the road of the kollel. But the 40-year-old also thinks, I wish I would have chosen the road of the hippie. You know, when I was 18 or 20, I could have made all kinds of choices. I could have gone on a motorcycle trip across the country with Susie or Janet or Catherine or whoever, and I didn't do it. I could have eaten whatever I wanted and dressed however I wish, and now I can't do these things because I'm locked into a certain system with a lot of peer pressure. Ah, but my son, son number two, son number one, he's going to fulfill the part of me that fantasizes the kollel life. Plus, son number two, he'll fill out a part of me that wants the other life. So when he wants to dress in kind of ridiculous colors and wants to put an earring on whichever ear, I guess it means different things in different cultures, which ear you put the earring on, I'm going to kind of subtly, maybe unconsciously, cheer him on. And that's why you can go, I'll never forget, the first Shabbos I served as interim rabbi in a synagogue in the Five Towns, which is probably the largest modern Orthodox synagogue in the world. And I went to a Shalom Zocher the first Friday night. I was interim rabbi, so I felt I had to go to the old Shalom Zocher. Then I found out that would just wipe you out totally and maybe even make you drunk. I came to a family where the parents were dressed what you would call, to use stereotypical terms, super modern Orthodox. No, it was Friday night, but they were dressed in kind of gold bronze shirt and long shorts and Bermudas and everything, sandals, but that was their Friday night garb. That was their big day Shabbos. And then the father of the child was a Shalom Zocher, was attending the Briska Yeshiva, and he was wearing Briska payas, and every other word out of his mouth was mamish and dafka. It was as if he never went to a secular school, although he did, and even graduated a very fine secular college campus, but then his life switched, so his language changed. But his brother across the table, and this was the brother who was allowed to come home for Shabbos, was dressed quite differently because he was in a very, very different place in terms of his intellectual, Judaic, etc. background. And then, of course, there was the other child who wasn't even at the table. You know, we have four sons at the table. We have the Rosha at the Seder. But there's usually a Rosha Marusha who's not even at the table, you know. So that's another one. How did it happen that this nice couple, you know, kind of left the center, modern Orthodox, had these four kinds of kids who were all over the waterfront? And the answer that Sterling would offer is very simple. Because inside those parents, and you don't have to be a super psychoanalytic person to see it, inside those parents, a piece of them was being acted out by each child. Hence the diversity, hence the extremes, etc., etc. I had this discussion with many, many people who then have this aha experience. Many, many parents, aha, now I understand why, you know, Shlomo's in Brisk and Shimon is in Berkeley, etc. Now I understand, because part of me wants to be in Berkeley and part of me would love to be in Brisk. I want to say something, and this is kind of Roman numeral 3b. So what time am I going to have to stop? 11:25. Okay. 11:30. Okay. Roman numeral 3b. Fascinating. I mentioned the other night, I guess it was Friday night, one of the OU programs of which I personally am very proud of is the JLIC program, Jewish Learning Initiative on Campus. It's interesting, the original initials were JLI, and then we started to get suits, you know, legal suits, because there are about 10 organizations out there with the initials JLI. And they said, how can you have a JLI, JLI, or something? Legally, in as gonish basturedin, you know, you can have 30, no one has a copyright or a patent on a JLI, but we changed it and we just added the C. It's Jewish Learning Initiative on Campus. We're now on 16 campuses. On each campus we place an educator couple, husband and wife, both of whom are Melumadim and Melumadot in Torah, both of whom have had a significant university experiences, postgraduate, graduate, whatever, and they devote usually 3 to 5 years of their usually early married life to serving as campus educators, not to do kiruv in the usual sense, but to do or not to do what the world calls kiruv rechokim, bringing close those who are far away, but rather kiruv kerovim, keeping in the culture people who are tempted to stray because of the temptations and obstacles of the secular Jewish campuses to Orthodox Judaism, to Judaism in general. So I was very, very supportive of this program, and still am. And now my emeritus position, I'm kind of like the wise old man that a lot of these educators turn to when they have issues. And their issues range, of course, from promiscuity to suicide, depression, homosexuality, all sorts of issues. And obviously, there are no easy answers. But I remember one of the really more savvy of these educators is a young man whose name is Rabbi Yehuda Sarna, who up until just now was the JLIC educator at NYU, but now he's become the NYU college, not Hillel. The NYU University has made him one of the chaplains, not just Jewish chaplains, but general chaplains, and they start to use him in various ways, and he's kind of really somewhat of an expert, not somewhat of an expert, but really a true expert, because he's been there. He's served, I think, for 6 or 7 years, he and his wife, whose name is Michelle, really special people. But Yehuda was once saying to me, I'm a person of not one generation earlier than Judah, Yehuda, but two, because he looks at me as I am, older than his parents. So he said, when you went to school, you know, college students were looking for meaning. Then there was another generation. And then they were looking for, not meaning anymore, but a meaningful experience. That phrase kind of stuck with me. And I realized that what works on these college campuses, and they're all very different, things work on different campuses. I mean, Lo Hare, Brooklyn College, Kahare, UCLA, Kahare, Harvard or Yale, or Princeton or Cornell. Each one, or Maryland or Penn or wherever, they're all very, very different. But Hatzad HaShoveh Shebehem, excuse me for speaking technical Talmudic language, is that kids no longer are looking for, I can't say all kids, I can't say never, but it's not so much intellectual meaning, philosophical understanding that they're looking for. They're looking for a meaningful experience. And therefore, this is rule number one in all kinds of kiruv, whether it's kiruv within the Orthodox world or kiruv reaching outside the Orthodox world. It is not the meaning, it's a meaningful experience. I can't say nobody, but very, very few people become frum or become more observant or more connected, whatever, because they studied Mora Nevuchim, the Rambam's Guide to the Perplexed, and they were convinced of the philosophical truths, etc. That's not the way it works. The way it works is you have a meaningful experience, which usually is a Shabbos experience, a Shabbos table, etc., etc. I encourage you, if you ever have the opportunity, to spend a Shabbos on the campus of Yale University. You will see something amazing. The JLIC program, all of the universities that we're associated with, works very, very closely and cooperatively with the local Hillel. That's a precondition for us sending a couple there, is that the Hillel will really cooperate in a meaningful way. And Hillel wants us and we want them, etc., etc. In Yale, Hillel has a beautiful, beautiful building, four-story building, etc., etc. Go to that building on Shabbos. That building is Shabbistic, all right? Everything going on there is Shabbistic. Not because we impose standards or halachos or whatever. It's open to every Hillel student. But the ones who come for the Friday night meal. They come for the shmooze. They come to see, there's a new couple there now, but the couple that's been there for the past 5 or 6 years had a large and growing family. They come to be with the little kids. They come to have a little kid on their lap at the Shabbos meal. They come to kind of hang out. They spend the whole Shabbos there. They're not all sitting and learning Pirkei Avos. Some are playing chess. Some are playing cards, word games, whatever. Some are just making out, whatever. That's the old term. I don't know if that dates me. But they're all doing it within that Hillel environment and the whole situation. But what's happening there is, with a few exceptions, there might be a little course on Hilchos Shabbos, maybe that's meaning as opposed to meaningful experience, but most of what's going on there is a meaningful experience, the experience of Shabbos and all that that means. psychologically, etc. It's interesting to me that no less a poet, and the Yesh Omrim anti-Semite, I know it's controversial whether he was or not an anti-Semite, but nevertheless he was certainly a great poet, T.S. Eliot. There's a line in one of T.S. Eliot's poems, I couldn't recover the line in time for this presentation, where he says that they're not even looking for, and he'd go back away, I mean he's dead, I don't know, 30 years or something, but he says that they're not even looking for a meaningful experience anymore, they're just looking for the experience. In other words, we've gone from meaning to meaningful experience to just the experience. And in a way, what Yehuda Sarna and the other JLIC educators and anyone working in this field is doing is taking kids who are looking for, quote, the experience and at least giving them a meaningful experience. And that's an entire population. It's the population of our own children, 18, 19 to 23, 24. It's where the action is, and it's where a lot is going on that very few of us have a handle on, but obviously which portends either hope or despair, depending upon which way you go from my drasha yesterday, has tremendous implications for the future of our community. And Roman numeral 5, the effects of internet pornography upon young marriages. Internet pornography, I don't have to say more about this. I don't want to give away a secret, but if you one day, I go on Amazon.com often, but if you make a mistake, and instead of going on Amazon.com, you go on Amazon.org, a very innocent mistake, and you move from the world of books or e-books or whatever to the world of the Be'er Shachas, the pit of decadence, etc. So kids can even, or all of us can accidentally stumble upon pornography. Pornography of this sort is very addictive. It's very, contaminates the soul, to use one metaphor. But what it does for sure is that it gives a distorted view of sexuality to many or most of our children, left to right in the Orthodox community, who have very little, if any, sexual awareness until they're married. And therefore, they come in on the wedding night and they expect one type of experience, etc., because they've had 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 years of very explicit pornography that they've become familiar with. And then they become, what should I say, extremely important, disappointed and extremely disillusioned and extremely dysfunctional sexually. So you have a marriage that starts off with extreme sexual dysfunction. A lot of it's coming from, and usually, at least in certain sectors of the Orthodox community, it is the male who is exposed to the internet pornography as opposed to the female. The female is totally, in the marriage, young marriage, is totally unaware of what's going on. The sexual relationship of a young, frum couple is in any case problematic. Even if you parcel out the influence of internet pornography, it's problematic and difficult and sensitive and tough. But when it's complicated by the effects of internet pornography on one or the other of the spouses, or it's one of the reasons for the rising number of divorces you see in the frum community of couples who have been married weeks, months, and have become divorced. I spoke a little bit kind of about the Roman numeral 6a, the midlife crisis of the Baal Tshuva. That's the Baal Tshuva who made his or her decision to become frum at age 18, 20, 22, and now is 38, 40, 42, or 52, or whatever. Whenever you have the midlife crisis, most of us have had several midlife crises. That's something that's not been written about too much, to my knowledge. But you can have several midlife crises. My kids often ask me to this day, Daddy, what are you going to be when you grow up? You know, a rabbi, a psychologist, or this, or that. I mean, make up your mind. But we go through all sorts of midlife crises. But it's only natural that in the midlife crisis, you reevaluate your decisions you made earlier in life. And if your decision was to become frum, which meant all that it meant, rejecting your parents in certain ways, living a different kind of life, etc., who does not have regrets? Sometimes these regrets are suppressed or repressed or whatever, but there are regrets. It's only natural. How does one deal with this? This is a very common issue that psychotherapists dealing with the Orthodox Jewish community have to deal with. And often they have to deal with what I call, my own diagnostic terminology, post-disillusionment stress disorder. There's such a thing as post-traumatic stress disorder, where one of the greatest traumas is becoming disillusioned, and it's very, very difficult to live in the Orthodox Jewish world these days and not become disillusioned. Disillusioned with our leadership, disillusioned with our followership, disillusioned with treasurers of major synagogues who were looked up to as the ideal of personal integrity, who are suddenly found guilty of the embezzlement of $600,000, and the way it was discovered is because the rabbi, who was a prince of Jewish spirituality, tried to cash his paycheck in advance, and I don't think he got a big paycheck, and these kinds of things every single day. It can be disillusioning, disheartening, etc. And how does one deal with this? This is something that comes up in psychotherapy, but in terms of the work that I do, because I see very few clients, but I see those who deal with clients, and this is a problem that they have. Because the material that their clients are presenting to them are showing them the underside of the Orthodox Jewish community, and this makes people become disillusioned. The intellectual answer to that is, well, you have to distinguish between the person and the religion. Yes, there are frum Jews who are everything, but frumkeit as a whole is wonderful and beautiful, etc. But to make that distinction and to keep it in mind is very hard to do from a emotional point of view. Maybe you can do it intellectually, but emotionally it's difficult. I referred you in the Roman numeral 7, the new Roman numeral 7, to Rabbi Chaim Rappaport, who was really an outstanding Talmud Chacham of the first rank, who works in England. He's a rabbi in a shul in suburban London, and he had the ongoing experience of working with homosexuals, Jewish homosexuals, and Orthodox Jewish homosexuals. That's an issue that I am not expert in, but something that I'm confounded by. There's a view out there within the Orthodox Jewish community that homosexuality is treatable. By the way, there are states in the United States where I could lose my license as a psychologist if I would even make that statement, that it's treatable, that it's in some way, form, or shape or form, it's a disease and can be treated. And some states are not even allowed to say that. And you know where the political climate is going in terms of the idealization of the gay life, etc. Legalization and idealization, etc. Can a homosexual who wishes to change his or her tendencies change or not? Is very, very dubious whether this real change is possible. What do you do with a person who wishes to change? Are there treatments? I don't know. I leave that as a big take-away, a big unresolved question, which needs to be further studied. And one person who at least certainly knows homosexuals well and has counseled them and certainly knows the halachic and hashkafic aspects of homosexuality, I refer you to his easily available book. In terms of eating disorders, I think that was covered quite a bit. Eating disorders is extremely prevalent in the Orthodox Jewish community. I don't care what anybody says. I think it's much more prevalent in the Jewish world than in the non-Jewish world in general, and certainly more prevalent in the Orthodox Jewish world than in the non-Orthodox Jewish world. I say this not based on any statistics or scientific research, but based on the numerous clinicians that I see. One woman told me, you know, if you're starting out in the field of social work or whatever, or you want to go into private practice, you want to have a full practice, just call up a few girls' schools left to right, Beis Yaakov or wherever, and tell them you see kids suffering from eating disorders and have a full practice in a matter of weeks. And I know, off the top of my head, can tell you the names of 5 or 6 women who have full practices dealing with, in one shape or other, to one degree of severity or another, girls suffering from eating disorders. One woman who's different from Meller, this fellow, Dr. Meller, who I mentioned, looks much more at the medical issues, genetic issues in anorexia, etc., biochemical, neurochemical issue, that's his area. But I've also heard from people who look at it totally psychodynamically and say, if adolescents like to rebel, and for boys in some sectors of the Orthodox Jewish community, if you want to rebel, you could become more frum than your parents, less frum than your parents, all sorts of ways of rebelling. But for a girl, unless she's really willing to cross some red lines, which hard for her to cross and become promiscuous or whatever, and she wants to really get to her parents, all she's got to do is stop eating. All she's got to do is stop eating. And this view of anorexia is, it's a part of an adolescent rebellion, at least it starts that way, and it's the adolescent rebellion that is the course of least resistance for a frum girl. A frum girl wants to act out, and yet not be called shiksa, or a rebel, or this or that. She's got an easy way to do it. She's got to just diet and diet, and sometimes diet becomes not only diet, but die. And because, as a rabbi I used to work with, it was a munkach, a talmud, an extreme right-winger, used to say, of course a psychotherapist can be mechalel Shabbos in the interest of a patient. Because take a look at all these anorexics. It's sakonas nefashos, pikuach nefesh. And anybody can become an anorexic with the way he looked at it. And therefore, anything you do, he had a very much, even though he was a shtreimel yedach, he had a very much more different, much different kind of level of heter for chilul Shabbos by a psychologist, not by a medical professional, but by a psychologist, because of his exposure to some suicides and the result of eating disorders, which were carried to a point where the girl unfortunately perished. So these are just some aspects of what I see in the area of the case studies that come to my attention. One of the things I do, and this is with this I close, with a lot of the people who come to me, is I tell them, I guess it was number three in the musicians Wachtel's list last night, tell them to pray. But I came across something, because prayer for many of us means you take off and open a siddur, and you pray what's in the siddur, and I'm not knocking that, that's terrific. But often the words in the siddur become a rather routine to many of us, and therefore lose their meaning. So there are various texts and sources in our tradition which encourage personal prayer. You make up your own tefillah. This can be done anywhere, anytime. My Bubby, my great-grandmother, who I was privileged to know until I was 11 when she passed away, when she was baking a challah, and the challah was not rising, she would turn to God and say, oh, Tata in Himmel, you know, help me with the challah. And that kind of prayer is very authentic prayer. So I suggest to professionals in the field that they invent their own prayers. Could be in English, could be in Hebrew, could be in Yiddish, could be in whatever language you want. And pray to God. And it could be almost anywhere. Obviously, there are places when it's not appropriate to pray. But, so what do you pray? So I came across a list of prayers in a book I understand is now being translated called Oleinu L'Shabeach. And it's various stories arranged according to the Parshios HaShavua. It's in Hebrew with 4, 5, 6 volumes. This is in page Tzadik Aleph 91 of the volume on Shmos. Here are some prayers. And this I conclude. Kaylee, my God. He got to first, you know, say, dear sir. In Hebrew, Shemar alai shelo echshov, shebechol hizdamnut, uvechol nosei, olai lahagid mashehu. Protect me from thinking that I have to have something to say about every occasion and every topic. Shemar oti mehadechifa lahastir inyanei kula. Protect me from the impulse, from the desire, to want to make everything better. Can't do it. God, save me from that impulse. It's a disease of the profession, right? It's a professional hazard for many of us. We want to change things, fix things, remedy things, cure things, make things better. God, teach me. I can't do that. I say, I'm going to skip around some. I say, Oti ba'al ratzon la'azor. God, help me with my will to help people, but make sure that I don't become someone who wants to tell people what to do. Helping and telling people what to do, two different things. Eineni me'ez levakesh et chazdecha al menat lichyot et sipurei yisurav shel hazulah. I don't dare ask you, God, to enable me to actually live the narrative of the suffering of the other. At least allow me the capacity to listen patiently to the person in suffering. I don't even want to have to empathize with them. I mean, maybe I can't even do that, but at least give me the ability to listen. Tein li lahavin shegam ani kein ani yachol litot. Help me understand that I can make a mistake. And on, these are the kinds of prayers that one can pray for, ending with tahbi, implant in me, et ha'ava lekulam, the love for all of them, detain li lahavchin bekishronotehem shel acherim, allow me to be able to find the strengths in the other person. Positive psychology, the strengths in the other person. Help me find those strengths in the other person. And most important, v'hayikar, tein li efsharut lomar lohem zot. Give me the ability to tell them the strengths that I see in them. Because as Goethe said, if you treat a person not as he is, but or she is, but as he or she ought to be and could be, you know, then you can affect real psychotherapy. Thank you.